Okay, this first one is a very brief overview of the whole book. I just found this on one of the websites.
What is the human project about? Much of our concern in the first half of life is about life, achieving, accomplishing, performing. The second half of life, once you've created your ego structure, you've got your identity, you finally have the courage to ask, what is this all for? What am I supposed to do with this? What prevents us growing into the second half of life is that we are so addicted by 30 or 40 to the task of the first half of life that it seems like the only game in town. So you need something to make it fall apart. This is what we mean by necessary suffering. Your soul, your emotional life is being expanded immensely through this falling. But if you can find grace or freedom in that falling, through that falling, in fact, you find that it moves your life forward, upward, broader, deeper, better. Just the opposite of what you first think when you fall. The ultimate spiritual benefit is that you find out by falling and afterwards realizing it's a falling upward, you find the meaning of your own life. I don't know if you find it any other way. Maybe the thing you'd immediately see in a second half of life person is they will strike you as grounded. They're not guarded. They're not overly self-protective. They're looking for ways to give themselves away. For the most part, we have pushed off the journey into the next world. And what I want to say is the further journey has to happen in this world. And then you're ready for heaven. You're living heaven now. You're practicing for heaven. And so heaven is not even a big change of venue. It's a continuation of what you've already begun to experience.
You know, I like him. He drives a truck, too. And I have three major... I have three major cliffs now. These are associated with the 3 days that Richard Rohr gave a presentation at his Albuquerque conference when he was in the middle of writing this book. And the three parts are first half of life, the transition is the second part, and the third clip is the second half of life. Pretty simple. So we'll get started on that. One of them is fairly long, so we got to get moving here.
Get a break from the pause if you need to.
Dan, you're on trying to describe the first half of life. Now, the vocabulary itself, the phrase, was first given in a common way by the Swiss psychologist Carl Jung. And when I first read it in him years ago, it made sense to me. But I probably, like most of us, was too young at that point to recognize how true it would eventually become. In short, and this is my layman's interpretation of Carl Jung, he would say that the first half of life is the task that we think is our primary task. And the second half of life is really the task within the task that a lot of people never get to because they're so preoccupied with the first task, which is rowing your boat with great effort. It's all about making money, getting an education, raising your children, paying for your mortgage. It's about tradition and law and structure and authority and identity, why I'm significant, why I'm important, why I matter, why I'm good. Most of us are so invested in that by the age of 40 that we can't imagine there's anything more than that. Well, you can see where that leads. That, in effect, if you stay there, to use our phrase today, it's all about me. Right? How can I be important? How can I be safe? How can I be significant? How can I make money? How can I look good? And how can I die a happy death and go to heaven? At least that was the Christian scenario. And as many of you have heard me say, even in this room, the religion itself became an evacuation plan for the next world, because we sure didn't see much happening of deep depth or significance in this world, right? It was largely a matter of survival. All it takes is what the spiral dynamics people call your lizard brain. The lizard brain, which is the lowest level of the brain, apparently. There's nothing wrong with it. We build on that. But like any good reptile, it's largely concerned with reproduction, security, and survival. And I'm sad to say, after 40 years as a priest, I think a lot of Christians have never lived beyond survival questions, security questions, even eternity was securing my future. And religion was an insurance plan to ensure that future. It's still all about me. Any sense of being a part of a cosmos, of being part of a historical sweep, that God is doing something bigger and better and larger than simply saving individual souls, my soul in particular, was largely of no interest to us. And I don't think I'm exaggerating. Was of no interest. We see that in the disinterest of so many of our people in questions of ecology, of justice on this earth. I've said for years, if you want to be assured of non-attendance at a Catholic lecture series, put justice in the title, right? And there will be three people, in the front row. Because that wasn't important to us. Always important was my private moral superiority, which was supposed to make me pleasing to God and supposed to save me. But what we never realized is it was still all about me. That's all the first half of life can do. Are you parents, thank God, and I mean that sincerely. God gives you hopefully enough age and maturity, actually usually not, but when the kids come to expand or expel some of your love and your generosity upon the kids. But even they are largely given very often in the early years questions of security, validation, identity, making money, going to the right college, looking good, wearing the right clothes. As Jesus said, why do you worry about these things? Huh? This is the way the pagans think. Huh? What will I eat? What will I wear? Security questions. If you want to be elected in a political office in this country or any country, all you have to do is assure people of safety. Now, in Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that's the first level, safety. Bill Plotkin, who's been such a wonderful influence on so many of our men in the last years, he speaks of the first half of life as your survival dance. And he speaks of the second half of life as your sacred dance. And he would totally agree with what I'm trying to say here. Most people never get beyond their survival dance. It's just identity questions, boundary questions, superiority questions, and security questions. What makes me special? What makes me safe? What makes me look good? Now in the age of psychology, we would call them ego questions. They're not, brothers and sisters, the questions of the soul. The soul moves so beyond questions of security and am I important, because it has found out that it is absolutely important, and that question is so deeply resolved that you don't need to keep trying to resolve it by spinning prayer wheels. I'm not against prayer. I'm speaking of prayer wheels, of various technologies and moral systems by which we try to prove that we're moral or superior or saved. In religion, it takes the form of being tied to what I'm going to call loyalty symbols, and every group has them, and you have to have them. You have to. Certain costumes and ways of doing things, signs of the cross, genuflections, vestments and religious habits and badges and the military outdoes the church in it. Every group does it. And you know yourself by titles and how many badges you have and where you are in the hierarchy of importance. And particularly the male of the species is especially inclined toward climbing in that hierarchy and get a little better title, a little higher title, you know, that's supposed to be significant. All of this is utterly boring to the soul. It means nothing. But after saying that, I want to say as strongly as I can, you've got to do it. You've got to do it. In fact, what we're facing right now, and I want to throw this in earlier so you don't misunderstand me, is an awful lot of people, we call it postmodernism, who don't even do the first task. They have developed no respect for authority, law, tradition, structure. They have no impulse control. As one of the wonderful speakers said yesterday, they're still 35 and they're still playing a guitar and letting mom pay their bills, right? Where you learn some degree of impulse control. We call it the law, the Ten Commandments. And it's necessary. Without it, you do not limit the imperial ego. You leave the imperial ego just wild and self-centered. And so you have to start with something like the Ten Commandments. I say in the book that we've had these fights in America over the last 25 years of different wonderful counties, usually in Texas, wanting to prove or assert that the Ten Commandments should be on the courthouse grounds. And that's okay, because law courts are first half of life institutions, and that's what we need them for, and that's what they're good for. But correct me if anybody knows better, I have never heard of anyone asking for the 8 Beatitudes to be put on the courthouse lawn. It wouldn't enter our mind. Because the 8 Beatitudes, and that second half of life wisdom, that just, blessed are the poor? This does not fit. Blessed are the meek? This does not fit American imperial thinking, nor Catholic imperial thinking. It's the way the system thinks. And pretty soon you're so invested in it that you call it religion. And it is most religion. It's all about the Ten Commandments. As you notice, a few times Jesus refers to them, he says, well, I assume you know that already, right? We've gone beyond that. That's just basic. For this world to survive, brothers and sisters, we better not steal from one another, right? We better not lie to one another. You better be loyal to your commitments, or the whole thing is going to fall apart. And of course, that's what's happening, because we're not even good at that anymore. But don't think, and this is what religious people do, even though Paul warned us strongly against it, well, Jesus did too, in the Sermon on the Mount, where he says, the law says, I say, the law says, I say, the law says, I say, seven times in a row. I won't do all seven, but try to remember, the law says, I say. Well, I grew up as a good Catholic boy in Kansas, it was just, the law says. And in fact, when I went to the seminary, and the Franciscans should have known better, it was still, the law says. In fact, the first day in the seminary, we were told, if you keep the law will keep you. It was a great way for the professors to get sleep, right? To get that bill of noise and testosterone control, to give us some impulse control. Great stuff. It really is. But don't call it spirituality. And that's what we've done. When we confuse the first half of life with the real goal of the journey. Religion is about union with God. And there are, as Rumi says, a thousand ways to meet We have to start in one little boxing ring to learn the rules. And you don't really dare, I don't think, break the rules till you know what the rules were there for in the first place. It's ironically, people raised very conservative and traditional who first of all learn the Ten Commandments and learn the rules and learn some impulse control and learn that they're not the center of the world and other people have rights, who are most prepared to go on to the second half of life. It's one of the great paradoxes. If you do the conservative thing right, if I can use that word, well, you have the best chances of continuing to move. And what we're facing now is a large percentage of our young people who haven't even done that. Now, God's still going to get at them, I'm sure. But they're going to come in a much more complex way, a much more difficult way. So one of the reasons that this language of the two halves of life so appealed to me from Carl Jung is it allowed me to affirm at the same time some deeply conservative values and what are often identified as very progressive values in the same breath, almost like inhalation and exhalation. They both are true. And we have a pseudo form of both of them, in my opinion, even in the church. And that's why the argumentation never ends. And why I tried in the last book to talk about non-dual thinking. I think it was you, Ron, who came up to the stage. He's so humble, he sits up there and listens to me at Anaheim. Then he comes up and tells me what he liked. I'm sure there were things you didn't like, but you never tell me that. But about 5, 6, 7 years ago, you said, and you just take 30 seconds of my time, and then you run away, and you said, so you wouldn't impede anybody else. You said, Richard, I don't know if these are your exact words, but you said, you have almost a mania for seeing everything in terms of both and. And you named it. I do. I'm obsessed with it. It's written in my genes, you know. And now we call it non-dual consciousness. That, for me, the ego always takes sides. The soul always reconciles sides. And doesn't need to over-identify itself with one or the other. Why, again, I'm going to run right to the spiritual resolution is because God has already resolved it in you. And when the two are put together inside of you, you don't need to keep identifying with one side or the other and proving that the other side is wrong or going to hell or the wrong religion or the wrong country. Or it largely ends up being a huge resistance to wisdom, a huge resistance to the depth we're gonna talk about later. So two halves of life language allows me to talk about what we might really mean by repentance, conversion, transformation. Choose whatever word you want. My experience is, and I might be wrong, but it seems to me up to now, largely what we meant by conversion or repentance was leaving one group and joining another, or leaving one set of behaviors and identifying with another. Are leaving one set of beliefs that we had in our head and accepting another set of beliefs. I call those belief systems, belonging systems. I don't think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think that asks very much of us at all. It's pseudo-transformation. It's no skin off anybody's back to say, I believe this, 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 this. We Catholics recite our Nicene Creed every Sunday morning. Little realizing it's creating an entirely different cosmology to live inside of. We go back to the same old American middle class cosmology and live pretty much like everybody else does. So if we're going to talk about transformative religion, really changing not just the way people think, but the thinker himself or herself, we've got to talk about what does transform us. I'm going to call that in the book the stumbling stone, what we have to stumble over. And then what does it start feeling like when you're on the other side?
I just have a personal question that I wrestled with over the last 5 years of my conversion from the first half of life to beginning into the second. Many of you know that I've been with the corporate world in my previous 35 years, and everything about the corporate world, as Richard said, is necessary, but we were always concerned with merit. You know, we had merit raises, we had merit reviews every year, and so the whole psyche was focused on trying to be better than somebody else. And I remember I had like 300 people working for me at one time, and we got all the departments together so we would have cross comments on everybody. We ranked all 300 of those people from 1 to 300, and their raises were portioned out to, you know, the big ones at the top got the big raises, and the ones at the bottom sometimes didn't get any. And so I had a hard time getting away from that, basically. And I wanted to ask you, what is the what's wrong with merit? What's wrong with doing your best at all the time? What's wrong with working hard? There's still nothing wrong with that, right? But I think what he's trying to tell us is that for this second half of life, supposedly when we don't need to worry so much about putting the kids through college, we have time to think about what's really important. Is that what everybody thinks the general message here is? That? Because I don't want to go around, not caring anymore. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Remember Ken Wilber. Transcend, but include. Include all of the discipline, the hard work, the understanding, and indeed some of the hierarchy. But you transcend it.
Leave it to Joanna to get us grounded in the truth. Thank you. Christy.
Well, just a quick comment. More and more you hear capitalism with the heart, or conscientious capitalism. So many top-level executives are reviewing some of this way of doing things. I'm thinking particularly of the founder of Costco. He put people first, not profit. And he looked at all the security he could provide them financially, insurance-wise, and they really have a pretty happy corporation, you know. So there's a change. It's affecting the first half of life slowly. So we are realizing that if money is the only goal, it's not necessarily the best way to.
It would be nice if we could see that trend continue.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I thought of healthcare, hospital healthcare. And I would say some people know how to play the political game, but much more than others, and do. And they may be way up there on your list because they know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I'm saying.
Okay. Yeah. Back there.
For me, it's more like personal integrity. You know, my values, based on my ethics and bringing that into play versus competing with somebody else, just it's within me. You see what I mean?
Uh-huh.
So it's having your own personal best. And that's a good thing. For me, it is. I don't see it.
Okay. Michael?
I appreciate your corporate example. I can relate to it. But I think businesses are saying that there's no limit to what you can accomplish if you don't care who gets the credit. And I think the last 20 years, a lot of management literature has moved much more away from the individual focus, the individual merit, to collective, to teamwork. And I think that's kind of what I'm getting from Richard in the book so far, is that the egocentric part of the first part of life, and then moving into more collective consciousness and awareness in the same time.
Okay, way back there.
I was really struck by Richard's comment that merit and validation mean nothing to the soul.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I that was very that said it to me. What so? If, then the question becomes, what keeps in my soul?
Okay, it means nothing to the soul, but as Joanna said, I'm still going to include that because it's part of my life, right?
Mm-hmm.
One more back there and we can go.
Yeah, thank you. With your reference to the corporate life, yeah, it's fine that we all do that, but how many compromises have we made in our basic being, our basic true self, our real self? To succeed, I don't think you can really succeed in the corporate mishmash and have, you know, what he wants us to put first in the second half of life be first for us. It has to come second. The cutthroat and the climbing on.
You're saying a typical corporate.
It's Hope for the Flowers, which is a wonderful book. It's all that.
So a typical corporate environment and second half of life are kind of incompatible, in your opinion?
Yeah. With me, they were. Yeah.
Okay.
He has a section in the book about living with the Cyclops. The Cyclops is all about the Cyclops and doing whatever you have to do to benefit the Cyclops and nobody else matters, and you know, he gobbles people up and so on. It's a very interesting comparison, and he gives you a list of things about how you know you're living with the cycle.
Okay, I think we better go on to the next section. We'll have more time to do this if you want to hang around until 2 o'clock, I think, because I got lots of stuff to do. This is supposedly the section on transition.
Start the transition talk from the first half to the second half of life by saying that your wonderful salvation project, which is what I'm going to call the first half of life, must kill you. It's in all of the great mythologies of the world. It's even so clearly in Jesus that death is the other side of resurrection, and there is no finding without losing. There is no finding without losing. There is no up without down. And in fact, we don't even know how to handle up unless we've been down. We will always abuse it for purposes of power, superiority, exclusivity, the things that have made the human project pretty disappointing, because so many of us have not been encouraged or allowed or even told that there was a further journey, or much less how to transition, how to migrate from one to the other. There's a lesser known theologian, he was a Swiss priest, Hans Urs von Balthasar. He had some influence at Vatican II. And toward the end of his life, he said that he felt all great ideas, I'm going to get his quote, as I actually have, all great thoughts finally spring from the conflict between two eventual insights. All great thought springs from the conflict between two eventual insights. Here's the way I would describe what he describes much better at length, the two great insights. The wound which we eventually find at the heart of everything is finally incurable. Never fully curable. The wound which we eventually find at the heart of everything is finally incurable. That's the first insight. The second, nevertheless, we must and are driven to try. When I first read it, I thought it was too glib or couldn't be true. And the more I stayed with it, my God, it's true. That's what sets up the conflict. That's what brings us to consciousness. That's what brings us to awareness. Now, the first half of life is so much fighting. No, it isn't incurable. I'm going to cure it. I'm going to fix it. I'm going to make it right. I'm going to be perfect. I'm going to be moral. I'm going to be superior. I'm going to be saved. I'm going to be rich. I'm going to be good looking. I'm going to be powerful. We all try it. Of course you do. But then the wonderful time of grace eventually shows itself. If you're honest about it, all that you've supposedly created for such pure motives, and it's really not true. There's a wound at the heart of it, an ego at the heart of it, a small self trying to define itself still at the heart of everything. So, brothers and sisters, the soul, it seems, has its secrets. That maybe I'll put it in even more directly religious language. If God wanted to hide God's self, so only the people who really wanted to find God and not just themselves would get there, God had to find a really clever place to hide the truth. He knew that most of us would assume that the truth or the good or the wonderful would be found at the top. Up. So God found the most clever place to find the truth, and it's at the bottom, down. The secret of the soul is that the way up is actually the way down, or if you prefer, the way down is the way up. Jesus says it in many different ways, as do most spiritual teachers. It's about as counterintuitive as you can get. None of us who are simply after our own advancement, our own self-promotion, our own security system, our own salvation project, will largely waste much of our life trying to promote ourselves, protect ourselves, defend ourselves. We only learn how to recover from falling by falling. And falling many times. Remember when you were a kid and you were learning how to ride a bike? You eventually get that feel for balance. And you only get that feel for balance by falling a number of times in your imbalanced position. The irony is that many people who we call leaders in the church, in the world, in our society, are people who've never fallen. And so they're really off balance. They're terribly off balance. That's what the spiritual traditions are saying. What a surprise. What counterintuitive wisdom. Now, we Christians put it in the language of the Paschal Mystery. Death. We all say we are saved by the death and resurrection of Jesus. You ask the person, what does that mean? Well, we're saved by Jesus. What does that mean? You're saved by Jesus. You're saved by the death and resurrection of Jesus. In the Apostles' Creed, we said he descended into hell before he ascended into heaven. I asked my third grade nun what that meant, and she said he went down there to get Noah. My little third grade mind will, what were Noah and Abraham doing in hell? So the supposed achievements of the first half of life have to fall apart in some way and show themselves to be wanting, or we will not move further. Why would you? This is why Jesus says the rich man doesn't have a chance. If the rich man is defined as someone who's always buying his way into comfort and convenience and avoidance of the downward journey. Normally, a job, a fortune, a reputation has to be lost. If you're really tied to your self-image, and if you've spent 45 years promoting it and defending it and polishing it and proving to yourself why you're so good, you're not going to let go of it. It has to be taken from you. Why would you give it up? So be careful, brothers and sisters, of especially any really shiny self-image, you know. There is an incurable wound at the heart of everything. You and your children and your husband and your marriage and the state of New Mexico and the United States and the Catholic Church and the Methodist Church. Damn it. Why does it have to be that way? And much of the conflict from age 25 to 55 is just trying to figure that out. Damn it, it shouldn't be that way. It shouldn't be that way. I don't accept it that way. I don't like it that way. I disapprove of it. I'm going to make it right. That's what I've spent much of my life trying to do. Many of you are ones on the Enneagram, you understand. We're the Mr. Clean of society, you know? So, a disease has to be endured, a house has to be flooded, a death has to be suffered, a marriage has to fall apart. There's just no exceptions. Don't be surprised when that happens. Don't look for someone to sue. What a waste. Oh, this shouldn't have happened to me. It's only rich people who have this illusion. It's all supposed to be tit for tat, quid pro quo. And as soon as my quid pro quo is taken away from me, my sense of retributive justice, 2 + 2 = 4, and I'm going to make it make four. As soon as that's taken away from us, we rebel and we look for someone to sue. That's why so many people by the middle of life are angry people. Just, and you talked about it yesterday, just they're so angry. And you can tell that they're not going to be a part of the solution, because they're revealing by their anger that they're part of the problem. There has been no deep transformation. The pattern is so clear that the way up is the way down and the way down is the way up, that one has to, I think, work rather hard or be intellectually lazy to miss this obvious lesson. It seems we have a blockage against it, kind of falling, what I call in the book necessary suffering. It's a whole chapter on necessary suffering. I think Carl Jung called it legitimate suffering. He says, if you do not accept the legitimate suffering of being a human being, you ironically and paradoxically bring upon yourself, in the long run, 10 times more suffering. We see this especially in people who do not do the task in the first half of life. No self-discipline, no impulse control, drugs, sex, and rock and roll through your teens and your 20s. And your life is so disordered, you are so incapable of marriage or child rearing, you bring on 10 times more disaster to everybody around you because you didn't have the discipline of the first half of life. So I want to keep reasserting this. In spiral dynamics, Ken Wilber and others use a marvelous principle that they keep reasserting. And I think I've spoken of it here in previous years. It's called transcend and include. That's the principle. That if you transcend to higher levels of consciousness, what gives away that it's authentic transcendence is it always includes the previous stages. It doesn't throw them out. This is crucial. But most of history hasn't known that. When we would come to a big new insight, we invariably would totally dismiss the previous church, the previous era, the previous century as all and totally wrong. We can't try to reform things that way anymore. It's never true. It's always a lie. Our ancestors on whose shoulders we stand were also partially right and partially wrong. And we got to have the humility and the honesty to garner and gather what was partially right and partially good. All or nothing reformations, all or nothing revolutions are not true reformations. They're not true revolutions. And the same in terms of the psyche. As we grow and we pass over into the second half of life, we don't now throw out the law. Maybe you were hoping I'd say that. That's mere rebellion. That's false transformation. He's the iconoclast who wastes years hating mom and dad, hating the church, hating America, hating what disappointed them. They're so upset with the dark side that they discovered, they don't know how to put the dark and the light together, so they just spend 20 years hating the darkness. Huh? That's a lot of our people who call themselves very often progressive and liberal. They're not gospel. It is progressive and liberal. It's not gospel. Because it's still too angry. It's still too all or nothing. It's still too oppositional. It's not wisdom. It's not holiness. It's not goodness. It's not love. It's not peace. So brothers and sisters, it's some kind of falling, some kind of necessary suffering, I think God has programmed into the journey. It's the wound that cannot be healed. All the sources seem to say it, starting with Adam and Eve and all they represent. So remember, the whole biblical drama begins with an act of transgression. And I'm going to call it necessary transgression. I know we pretend to be real disappointed that they ate the apple. But you've got to know, that's the whole storyline. They had to eat the apple, right? There is no story without it. That's how the conflict is set up. That's how you break through consciousness. You've got to transgress. You've got to do it wrong. You don't come to God by doing it right. That's the great surprise. Doing it right just makes you fall in love with yourself, not God. Please, Paul says that in 3 Philippians, I think it is. Huh? And he says that it took me so long to see this that I was just in love with myself and my own superiority. You don't come to God by doing it right. Jesus says this in the story of the prodigal son. There's one son who does it right, one son who does it wrong. And he says the one who did it wrong, in fact, is right, and the one who did it right, in fact, is wrong. How could he make it any clearer? There's another story, the publican and the Pharisee. One does it right, and the other does it wrong. The one who does it wrong is right, and the one who does it right is wrong. We can't see it because we don't want to see it. It just flies in the face of the way we've lived our whole life. And you were told to live your whole life. You were supposed to obey those 10 commandments. I hope you did. But you're finally going to get to a situation somewhere in your 30s or 40s or 50s where you say, you know, just obeying those commandments doesn't really get me anywhere. It's not teaching me how to love. It's not teaching me how to forgive. I'm not throwing it out. Now, I'm still going to not steal and not lie, but that's only the starter kit. Or as Paul calls it in Galatians, it's the nursemaid or the midwife to get you born, to get you in the right ballpark.
I'm going to stop here, take our break. There's more of this to come.